Welcome to the Barnes Review History Hour. This is your host, John Friend. Today is Thursday, August 18th, 2022. The Barnes Review History Hour is a program where I will be interviewing contributors to the Barnes Review History Magazine, a bi-monthly print and digital publication dedicated to bringing history into accord with the facts, as well as other special guests. Please do consider subscribing to the Barnes Review if you are not already. Check out barnesreview.org for all the details. And today I am joined by Harry Cooper, who sits on the board of contributing editors of the Barnes Review magazine. Okay, Harry Cooper, welcome to the program, sir. It's great to connect with you.
My pleasure.
Yeah, thank you so much for taking the time. I have followed your work over the years, and there's going to be plenty to talk about. To get started, you are on the... you're on the board of contributing editors to the Barnes Review, the bi-monthly history magazine dedicated to bringing history into accord with the facts in the spirit of Dr. Harry Elmer Barnes. You were an associate of the late Willis Cardo, the legendary publisher. The legendary publisher and political organizer who founded the Barnes Review back in, I think it would have been 1994. And, of course, you're probably most well-known for your organization, Shark Hunters International, which is dedicated to telling the honest, true, and accurate history of the German U-boats and the men who served on them. So, we'll have definitely plenty to talk about. But I wanted to start off, I got to ask you, what was your relationship like with Willis Cardo? What sort of man was he? I never actually got the chance to meet him in person, unfortunately.
Oh, that is unfortunate. He joined Shark Hunters. I didn't know who he was. He joined Shark Hunters, I think it was 1989 or thereabouts. And when he joined, he said, I should not list his name because there are people that would not treat me kindly if they knew I was a friend of W.C. Cartos, the way he signed up. So I said, no, I'm not afraid what people are going to say about me. So he and I got to be good friends. We lived in Tampa at the time, and he had a radio station, I think, in St. Petersburg, right across the bay. So he came down quite frequently, and he and I and my wife and our brand-new little baby son, who's now 34 years old, we used to go to this really great Cuban restaurant about 8 blocks from where I lived. Willis and I got along great, and when our first book came out, 25 or so years ago, Willis had a big extravaganza there in Washington, D.C., and I was invited, and I attended, and I talked about the first book, and Willis and I have been friends ever since. We moved over here to the West Coast in a quiet little town I jokingly referred to as Hillbilly Heaven because it's so quiet, so peaceful. And every so often, Willis would come to Jacksonville. I guess he had relatives or something. And he and I would get together in St. Augustine, and we'd have burgers and beer on the upper deck of the A1A Ale House looking over the Intercoastal Waterway. Willis was a great guy.
Good. Yeah. That's cool. That's a cool story. And I'm glad that you're not embarrassed or ashamed to be affiliated with him, because he did build up quite a reputation for just dedicating himself to finding out what was really going on in the world and what our true history was, and publishing it and supporting people who were investigating these sorts of issues. So that's pretty courageous.
It did kind of bite me in the ass one time, though, because I didn't know I was on the board of contributing editors to the Barnes Review. I had sent some articles that he posted in the review, and I didn't even know he put me there as a contributing editor. And then along come the Spitlickers, otherwise known as the Southern Poverty Law Center, and saw that I was listed there. And they called me up and started telling me I was a Nazi and all that. And I told the woman, just, I'm not a Nazi, not now, nor have I ever been. And she kept pressing. I said, look, I know where you're going, so just invent whatever you need to. So now I'm listed on their website as a neo-Nazi. And I've never been a Nazi one way or the other. And you don't even know what a Nazi is anymore. Plus, they listed my group, Shark Hunters International, which you can find at sharkhunters.com, listed us as a hate group. Ronald Reagan was a member. I'm sitting here looking at the Presidential Medal of Merit that he gave me. The four Medal of Honor winning American submarine commanders were members. One was sat on my sofa as a guest. The last commander in chief of the Soviet Navy is still a member. He didn't know he was a Nazi. He thought he was a commie. But, you know, those people have money coming out their ears. They said I'm a Nazi. They're liars. And if you're listening, Spitlickers, go ahead and sue me.
Yeah. Well, I did see your profile on the Southern Poverty Law Center's website, and I'll probably bring that up as we proceed, because they not only are you, you know, denounced as a neo-Nazi and all this other stuff, but also a conspiracy theorist, which is basically just...
Oh, I didn't know that. I'm a conspiracy theorist?
Yeah, that's one of their favorite derogatory, slanderous terms that they throw at people that simply think for themselves and question the information that they're consuming. Mm-hmm. So, you know what, we'll get into that as we proceed here, but... Oh, go ahead.
Is that a promotion from neo-Nazi?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what's worse or what's better, a conspiracy theorist. I think, I mean, you know, the way they characterize me, I'm a conspiracy theorist, a neo-Nazi, anti-Semitic, Holocaust denier. So I have, like, all four of the slurs that they use. So I don't know.
They can't really point a finger at me and say I'm anti-Semitic. One of my best friends, who is one of the strongest supporters of Shark Hunters, is a Jewish guy, lives in Chicago. He hates the Southern Poverty Law Center, and he hates the disinformation. And he married a very lovely black lady. So, and they're all good friends of mine. So I guess I'm not anti-Semitic. And my very best friend ever was a guy named Mike Epstein. He was a soldier of fortune like me. And we had an agreement that if one of us got into another country and got in a jam, the other one would come in and somehow get him out. Unfortunately, Mike lost his battle with cancer about 4 years ago. So I guess I better not get into trouble in some other country.
Right.
So I'm not anti anybody except liars, bullshitters, haters, and stuff like that. I judge every person on their own merits. I don't care if you're black, white, yellow, red, brown, if you're Jewish, Christian, I don't give a damn. If you're a good person, fine. If you're a jerk, I was going to say asshole, but I can't say that on radio here. And if that's the way the person is, I'm not shy about telling them right to their face. That's another
nice thing
about Florida. You can't put your hands on a senior citizen or you go to prison. So I can say whatever I want to somebody. They don't dare take a swing at me because it's a third degree felony in Florida if you smack an old person.
Well, good for you. That's very well said. I completely agree with you, and I think that's how most people listening to this program would describe themselves. I mean, we're not just irrational anti-Semites or racists or haters or anything like that. We're just telling the truth and trying to pursue the truth, and we're not afraid to openly talk about controversial topics. And that's it. So let me first start off by asking you. Yeah. Let me first start off by asking you to maybe kind of just like introduce yourself and really tell us how you founded and when you founded Shark Hunters International.
Oh boy. Okay. I'll cut to the Reader's Digest version. I was born one day after the German troops marched into Poland. So I was a kid during the whole war, and Germans were all horrible Nazis. We knew that because that's what the press said. And after the war, I never gave it any thought. I joined the U.S. Air Force because I wanted to kill Russians, because that was the enemy at the time. And now, of course, я вас по-чуниверски подводник. I'm an honorary Russian submarine officer. And I was a commissar of the Soviet Union, but that's a long story. I was an up-and-coming executive in Chicago, and I also drove race cars professionally. And I used to spend Sunday afternoons at 180 miles an hour on the super speedways, and there ain't nothing in the world that's as much fun as thundering down the racetrack at 180 miles an hour with 800 horsepower under your feet. But then My last race was a million years ago, 1976, the Texas 500. And I was in the lead group of nine cars, and my engine blew. And I was on my way back home to Chicago, and the engine in my truck blew. I was a damn good race car driver, but I wasn't a very good engine builder, apparently. So my crew chief had quit. My assistant crew chief had quit. I got back to my office and found out that my boss had quit, and the guy who replaced him was a clown that I couldn't get along with. So I just quit my job and came back to the marina where I was living on my boat at the time. And my wife, I had just gotten married. My wife was the general manager of the marina. And I came home about 11 o'clock that morning, and she says, "What are you doing home?" That was Friday, 31st of July, I think it was, in 1987. I said, "I just quit my job. We're moving to Florida. We're going to do Shark Hunters seriously, because all these people are going to be dead." And she says, "Have you forgotten I'm pregnant? Where's the insurance?" Well, what had got it started was some years before, I started researching, and I found that the story about the raving Nazis and all that was propaganda. You cannot tell, if you're an officer, you cannot tell your men, the guy on the other side of the battlefield, he loves his country like you love our country. He loves his wife and kids and wants to get home alive just like you do. He goes to the same church you do. Now go kill him. People would start thinking, wait, there's something wrong with this picture. So you have to make the enemy appear like a horrible monster, or nobody wants to kill anybody, and you can't have a war unless people want to kill one another. In World War One, they told us that German U-boat guys would rape young women to death and fire their lifeless bodies out the torpedo tubes. Nobody bothered to sit down and think, where the hell are you going to get young women out in the middle of the ocean?
Right. The anti-German propaganda. Yeah, the anti-German propaganda. I don't mean to interrupt you. I was just going to say briefly.
Yeah, go ahead.
The anti-German propaganda was just so over the top. Even in World War One, as you mentioned, but also in World War Two. I mean,
right.
Do you remember, you know, you can even still see them online. You can find the old posters of a German soldier with like a bayonet, and there's like a baby on it, and like stuff like that, and these
yeah,
like these horror stories that were just so almost like truly out of like a Hollywood horror film, and yet this is presented as like
that is where it came from.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And
it,
I mean,
it, came
it was
from
presented
Hollywood.
As
they did the propaganda out there.
Yeah, exactly. So all of this propaganda was designed to demonize the Germans and to incite, you know, people like, I don't mean people like you, but just, you know, soldiers and just the general public in general to hate the Germans.
Of course, people like me. When I was 18, I joined the Air Force and I had to go kill a Russian.
Right.
But I've spent time in Russia. As a matter of fact, the first time I was there, I was invited by the commanding admiral of the Soviet fleet, who was ordered by Mikhail Gorbachev to invite me over. And I only found out recently that the reason that happened is because Ronald Reagan was a member of Shark Hunters, and he and Gorbachev had became friends. And so they took care of me. I paid my own airfare, but then they put me up in a nice apartment, and I was a VIP because I got 8 squares of toilet paper. But we had what they call a round table meeting. Them Russians love round tables. I was standing with my translator, who I found out later was chief of intelligence for the Soviet Navy, and all these admirals were seated at this round table. There must have been about 15, 16 of them, and each one from my left was taking a turn asking me questions about submarine history. And all this time, this admiral right across the table from me was with gray mutton chop sideburns, was just staring at me with icy blue eyes. And it came his turn to ask me a question. And instead of submarine history, he asked me, "Why are you here?" And I pointed right at him. And I said, "I was told that you're my enemy." He got very stiff. I said, but you were told that I was your enemy. Yeah, and he grudgingly admitted. I said, I don't see an enemy here. I see a man like myself who wants his children to grow up in a peaceful world where there's no fighting, no bloodshed, nobody dying. And he agreed. And I said, so let's have a toast with Pepsi, a great American invention. He said, no, with the vodka, a great Russian invention. I said, okay, see, we get along already. And John, like somebody threw a switch, they were all smiling. They were all on their feet. They were tearing their medals off their uniforms and pinning them on my jacket. People are people. No matter where you go, they put their pants on one leg at a time like you and I do. They want to have a peaceful life. They want to make a good living, provide for their family, and not have to worry about crawling around in ditches or getting shot out of the sky. They just want peace and quiet. So,
Really cool. That's a really cool story. And that sort of goes to like the heart of your mission. I was reading the mission statement on the website. You actually click the link and it takes you to a PDF. And the third mm-hmm. item is to bring former enemies together as friends. And it's incredible hearing you explain this because it sounds like it started off as, you know, you're focused primarily on the German U-boats and their history right. and the veterans, you know, that served on these U-boats. But it sort of expanded to, you know, the Soviet Union and other countries you visited as well, correct?
Way more.
Yeah, yeah, I know. That's such a noble purpose, for sure.
We were just getting started, and my friend Epstein, I told you, was my best friend. He used to put tours together. He was a paratrooper in the U.S. Army. He'd put tours together for guys who were jump qualified to go to this country, that country, whatever, and jump with their military. So I decided, hey, I'd do that. And we lived in Chicago, so I planned a convention for Key Largo in February 1987 to get us out of the cold. And we came down there. And there were a lot of American U.S. Navy veterans, and there were 11 German U-boaters, three commanders. One was had the Knight's Cross. He was also the youngest combat submarine commander probably ever in history. He was just barely 21. We got everybody got to be friends, and one evening we were sitting at the bar. I'm Irish. I used to drink a lot. I gave that up, as a matter of fact, because I got so damn drunk at that convention. But I was sitting at the bar trying to set a new record for how many pina coladas they'd sold. And on my right was this commander, Hans-Georg Hess, who became my best friend in Germany. He was a doctor of law after the war. And on my left was a guy named Ray Lankheim, who was a gunner on a U.S. Navy destroyer. And they got to talking back and forth across my face. What was your area? Well, that was my area. When were you there? Well, that's when I was there. And then Captain Hess blurted out, he said, oh, the number on your destroyer was such and such. And Ray says, yeah, how did you know? And Captain Hess said, on such and such a day, I fired two torpedoes at your destroyer, but somebody must have seen the torpedoes, and you turned, and I missed. And Ray Lankheim says, yeah, I remember. And he named the lookout, and he's kind of arrogant. And he said, so you missed, Captain. What do you think about that? And Hess slammed his big fist down on the bar. Says, well, I'm glad we missed. We have more time for beer now. And the two became best buddies.
Wow, that's funny. Now this was
the following year.
This was before you were doing this full time, like with the organization.
Correct. I was still a vice president of a company back there in Chicago. But then Captain Hess said, "Next year you must come to old Europe." And I, oh my God, I've never been off this continent. And then I realized, yeah, why not? So we went over there. We had about 50, 60, 70 Americans came over, and we stayed in a hotel that was run by a Knight's Cross winning submarine commander, and we had a farewell dinner. And John, I'm a tough guy, but I had tears in my eyes. After the dinner and the speeches and all the bullshit, they had an orchestra, a chanting choir, and I made sure we had round tables. I made sure we didn't have a bunch of Germans over here and a bunch of Americans over here. It was every other one at the table, a German and American, etc. And they were playing a song, and everyone, it must have been 20 or more tables. Every table, John, the people had interlinked their arms, and they were swaying to the music. And I was thinking, how could we have ever shot at each other? And that just, you know, I was so fortunate I got to meet all these great warriors, Americans too, unlike these wannabe Johnny-come-lately websites who don't know anything. But Otto Kretschmer, the top submarine commander of the war, he sank more ships than some navies sank, and he was out of the war before the U.S. was in it. I had a sleeping room in his house, and he considered me part of the family. He was over here to visit, too, and his wife. Erich Topp, the third most successful submarine commander. I've been to his house I don't know how many times. They just opened all the doors for me. We sell hand-signed fine art prints. And I'd say, hey, I got these prints we want to sell. Would you be willing to sign 1,000? Yes, come right over. So, and let me hasten to say, I don't make any money at this. I'm a volunteer. Everybody in Shark Hunters is a volunteer. Any money comes in goes to run Shark Hunters. So those guys were so damn nice. We had an American merchant captain, Captain Peter Chelimedos. He was telling me he got sunk in the North Atlantic by a German U-boat. Fortunately, thank God, none of his guys were hurt. And they were all in the lifeboats bobbing around, and the submarine came up alongside, and the skipper yelled down to Peter, because he was the skipper, asked, was anybody injured? Do they need medical help? No, everybody's fine. So the U-boat commander said, I'd like to give you some fresh water, but our desalinator's down. Will you take a couple cases of beer instead? So,
oh, wow.
You know, these were the most, these were the most honorable warriors, you know, and I knew some of the air commanders, and they had told their pilots, if you shoot an American pilot while he's in his parachute, I'll personally shoot you with my own pistol when you get back to the base. Shoot them down in their airplane, but once they're hanging in the chute, get away from them.
Now, you're talking about the Germans?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, yeah, and that's so true, and that basically dovetails with much of what I've read about the German military. And, I mean, the German military has a long, very, very honorable, respectable history. It's been a key part of, like, the German culture going back centuries, and I've always been very impressed. I remember reading a book when I was in high school, like a history of the German soldier. And it always was very interesting to me. And I never really went along with the whole World War II narrative, or at least it didn't really it was never really impressed upon me that they were like these evil monsters or anything. So I quickly kind of saw through that. But most people don't, and they just have this very distorted narrative of not only World War II, but also just Germans in general and the way they acted during World War I and World War II. And that's a key mission of Shark Hunters, right? I mean, is to basically explain to the world what type of men they really were, not only in the U-boats, but I guess just the broader German military effort. Is that right?
Pretty much, yeah. It started out to tell the history of the U-boats and the U-boaters, because I knew so many of them. And then through them, I met a lot of the flyboys. And also some of the Waffen-SS. Oh, man, you say SS and people's toenails curl up. Oh, horrible death camp people. Well, first, I'm not even getting into the death camp story, but the Waffen-SS were like the Green Berets of the day. They were the toughest fighting soldiers anywhere. And any American soldiers I've talked to who fought against the Waffen-SS had very high respect for them because they fought cleanly but tough. They had the worst attrition rate of any of the walking armies because they just didn't know how to give up. So, and so many of them, and this is another whole story, over 1.1 million were deliberately starved to death under orders of Eisenhower after the war was over.
Oh, yeah.
So.
I should say a topic that the Barnes Review has covered extensively over the years. And something that's,
sure,
you dealt
with a guy named James Bach.
Yes. Yeah, the Canadian historian who wrote, I think it's called Other Losses.
That's correct. He called me about a million years ago and told me he was going to start this book. I told him, I think that's an awesome idea. Go ahead. I said, you know, any help I can give you. He said, well, you have many German military veterans from the war in your membership. I said, yeah, hundreds of them. And then he says, good. You will give me all their names, addresses, and phone numbers. I said, whoa, hold on there, Charlie. I don't give out. I had to raise my right hand and swear an oath to a couple of the skippers that I would never release anybody's contact. So I said, no, I can't release any contact. However, you tell me who you want to talk to, and I'll set up an interview. No, you will give me all that information. So I probably shouldn't say on the air what I told him, but I hung up. So his book was great, really great, but it could have been better. He's dead now, you know. He died some years ago.
Right. Well, so, okay,
we've got some books that were written by guys who lucked out and survived these starvation camps. Some of them, for God's sake, these poor bastards, sound asleep at night, and the bulldozers are coming through and burying them alive.
Yeah, it's truly, truly, truly horrific, yeah, what a lot of these guys went through, you know, after the war was over in many cases. So it's really a major scandal that it just isn't even known, really, in the West, certainly in America. But I'm curious, so basically the organization really sounds like it came into fruition in the late 80s, and you've been, you know, it's a membership organization from what I understand, and you... over the years, you've organized trips to Europe and other places to sort of give members a firsthand experience with some of these historical sites, and also to kind of network
and
meet people.
And to,
yeah, exactly, yeah.
To meet the people.
So I'm curious, how do you...
Nazis, according to the Spitlickers. That's why we're Nazis.
I'm curious, how does one become a member, and where are most of your members located? I mean, are they mostly... Americans and Germans, or are they really from all over the world at this point?
We had members in 77 countries.
Wow, that is awesome.
And to become a member, your people can just send me an email, sharkhunters@sharkhunters.com, and say you want information, and I'll send it to you.
Okay, very good. That's easy enough.
We had members in countries that don't even exist anymore. We had members in the Soviet Union. That's gone. West Germany, East Germany, those countries are gone. But we still have members there.
Right.
So.
Very good. That's cool. So how many, I mean, it's probably been too many to even count at this point, but how many excursions have you organized, and what has been the response in some of the countries that you visit?
Usually it was one a year to Germany and Austria. I always went twice a year because, I like those countries, and I visit with those people. And now once a year down to Argentina also. But since the Kung Flu virus came along, you can't travel anywhere. However, now they're relaxing the demand for the jab, which I won't take. And so now I'm going back down to Argentina in November. One of my guys down there was really sharp. About 2 years ago, he found the estate that was owned by one of the pilots that brought Hitler down to Argentina. Yes, he did not die in the bunker. And this pilot died just a couple of years ago, and the place was abandoned. And we wanted to get down there before the looters got there. We never take anything. We just take pictures and films, but we wanted to get there before the looters got there. So I'm going down there in November, and there's a lot of places we'll be visiting down there, just myself and another researcher.
Okay, so this isn't like one of your organized members trips, is just a private trip that you're
taking?
That
is correct.
Okay.
That is correct. We'll be bringing members down there again probably late January, early February, which is fall for those guys down there. It's pleasant weather. And then we'll be going to Germany the end of September and early October to visit various places of history. And, of course, to go to Oktoberfest, which is actually in September. And Oktoberfest is something everybody should go to at least once in their life. But I go to it every year. I usually wind up sleeping on the bus until everybody comes back because it's, you know, it's fun. It's a lot of fun. It's probably the biggest beer party in the whole world. And it is specifically to, well, it's to remember the wedding feast of King Ludwig II, I think it was. But it's also to showcase all the Munich breweries. And you go into these big beer tents that are monster huge size. They fit about 1,000 people in them. And each one has a loud oompah band, and they're trying to drown out the guys next to, in the next tent. And everybody is succeeding, driving everybody else out. But it's just so damn much fun. The food is great. If you like beer, I'm not a very good Irishman. I don't drink beer. But if you like beer, you got all sorts of beers to choose from. Got carnival games and all sorts of stuff. It's a great place. And then we go to historic places. We go to the various castles. We go to places where there are bunkers and tunnels that most people don't even know about.
That's awesome. That sounds like a great experience.
Yeah, and if people want to go to sharkhunters.com, that's my website, sharkhunters.com, click on where it says tours. All the tours are listed there, and most of them have tons of photographs.
Cool, very good. So I want to ask you, could you give, and we sort of already addressed this, but can you, like, just in a nutshell, tell us the unvarnished truth about the German U-boats? I mean, this really has been sort of your focus, the history of the U-boats, what, you know, what type of men served on these boats and sort of like their conduct and what they were about. Can you kind of just address that question briefly?
Absolutely. First off, they had the worst attrition rate of any military force ever in history. And that was one of the things that got me to writing the history correctly. For instance, in the U.S. Navy, our submarine force had the worst attrition rate of any American service. One man out of seven got killed. That's a hell of a lot of people. But on the German side, it was the opposite. One man out of seven came home. They still were the only oversubscribed branch of the military. They were not allowed to belong to the so-called Nazi party, the NSDAP. They were not allowed to join that. And so you see the pictures of the guys, the real pictures. If they're saluting, they're doing the military salute, not the party salute, which in reality was the Roman salute, but we won't get into that. These were the best of the best, and they lost 28,383 men.
Quick question just to clarify. Were they technically under the – like what part of the military were they – under, like, for like an organizational purpose, or was it something
Navy.
Totally separate?
No, they were in the Navy.
Okay, so it was part of the German Navy, which was
right.
Independent. Okay, but like basically independent from the party, right? Is that's what you're getting at?
Absolutely. They were not allowed to belong to any political party, and at the beginning of the war, I think there were 60 something political parties in Germany, and Admiral Dönitz, who was Captain Dönitz at the time, made it an order. Nobody could belong to any political party.
Okay, and very interesting.
They, in the early stages of the war, they stopped to help people that they sank. They were out to sink ships, not to kill men. But once the Allied anti-submarine technology got so good, they didn't dare stay on the surface. So they'd sink a ship and go away. But they never tried to kill them. The Japanese, those bastards, they did. They tie people up and torture them to death on the deck of their sub. That's another whole story. The German guys, honorable. And after the war was over, Admiral Otto Kretschmer, the top commander, top submarine commander ever of World War II. He became a rear admiral with NATO. Erich Topp, the guy who sank the first American warship by mistake, he became a two-star in NATO. So many of them went back in. And if they had been the horrible people that they claimed, machine-gunning people in the lifeboats and all, they would not have been allowed back into NATO.
Right. So. Yeah, they were very honorable military men, it sounds like. And they the German U-boats were extremely – I mean, from what I understand, I'm certainly no expert. You know, I've definitely don't have the knowledge that you do. But, I mean, my general impression was that they were extremely – not only professional, but very sophisticated. They were very well organized. They were operating all over, right? I mean, they had patrols and you know, along America's coast. Can you kind of talk about like their tactics and like their overall mission during the war?
Right. In the early stages of the war, they pretty well had the run of the sea. After a while, the British and the American technology caught up and surpassed them. And after Black May of 1943, it was a downward slide for the boats, but they would, and there's a book I'm finishing right now about refueling. Okay, we think about American submarines. They get all loaded up at Pearl Harbor. They take off and spend 3 weeks getting over to Japan, run around there for a while, sink ships, and they take 3 weeks to get back home. The German boats, especially the Type 7, which is the one you see in all the Wolfpack movies and Das Boot, which was an awesome movie. Those are all sevens. They didn't have the legs to get that far. And as I'm just now going through some of my documents, they would go up as far as the Azores, meet a submarine tanker, take on more fuel, then go attack off the American coast. And yes, you betcha, every harbor on the American East Coast and Gulf Coast was mined once or twice or more by German U-boats. Fortunately for us, the mines all got swept except some mines that were laid by U-701 in front of Charleston Navy Base. A couple merchant ships went down on those mines. But they were all over the place. Operation Drumbeat, Paukenschlag, was the United States declared war on Germany or vice versa, depends on how you read it, in December. So at Hitler told told him to send all available submarines against America. He only had six available, and one was still in the shop. So three of them got on station quickly, and two more followed. And they were sinking ships like ducks in a shooting gallery because the businesses in the U.S. along the eastern seaboard didn't want to shut off the lights. It would hurt their business. So the U-boats would stand out to the sea, away from the steamer lanes, and the ships would come by, and they'd be backlighted by the cities, and they were sinking ships like mad, and the U.S. Navy had nothing to combat the U-boats in the early stage of the war. Admiral King was Chief Naval Operations, CNO, and he wanted to build carriers and cruisers and battleships, and the people are saying, we need destroyers to go kill these submarines off our coast. And so for the first about 6 months of the war, the skippers would come back to their French port to show off their sunburned crew, to show that they could run on the surface, let their men sunbathe, and the U.S. Navy had nothing to attack them with. So after a while, then the tables did turn, but they operated the bigger boats, the Type 9s, operated off South Africa. Some even went into the Pacific and worked with the Japanese. But
wow,
That's the rare one. Most of the battle was North Atlantic.
Right. And how many men would be on like a typical U-boat? I mean, obviously it sounds like there were various sizes, but like a,
right,
you know, a typical one, how many men would man it?
The Type 7 is the most highly produced. I think they made about 800 and something Type 7s. And a typical crew was anywhere, depending on the mission, anywhere from 45 to 55 people. 45, 46, 47, that was enough. But if they had like some of them were outfitted with a lot of extra anti-aircraft guns, so they had to carry along some gunners, or if they had a special mission, they'd carry along extra people. The Type 9s normally had about 55 people on board. The Type 9D2, which was a very big submarine, would carry 65, 70 people. That was a stretched version. They carried enough fuel on board a Type 9D2 to go around the world 1.5 times. So
wow,
they didn't need refueling.
That is crazy.
And yeah, they were all over the place.
You know, and I've always been so impressed with the engineering involved with creating a submarine. I mean, it really is masterful and just very, very impressive.
Yeah, because you can't have anything go wrong when you're cruising along at 300 feet deep. Or the German boats would cruise along much deeper than that. They could go deeper than all the rest of the country's different types of U-boats or submarines because they had heavy steel and it was a welded construction, whereas in the early days, a lot of the other ones were riveted. And so when an American or a British skipper says take her deep, he means 300 feet. When a German guy says take her deep, he means 300 meters, which is about 900 feet. That was rare. Most of them didn't get down there. One of our members, Guggenberger, Fritz Guggenberger, wanted to see how deep he could take his submarine. It was a Type 7, I think 7B. He got down to about 750 feet. And you could hear creaking and crackling all over the place. And so they finally surfaced. And a friend of mine, Gerhard Richter, was the radio operator on that boat. And he said when they got to the surface and looked at it, it looked like an underfed plow horse with the ribs all caving in. So,
oh, wow. That is crazy.
When Otto Kretschmer was hit and he was sinking, he told me that he was passing 728 feet when he gave the order to blow the tanks. So those boats were tough, but if anything goes wrong,
they had their limitations though.
That's it. The key to a submarine is stealth. If you can attack enemy merchant shipping and not get spotted, okay, you'll live to tell another day. But if you get spotted by the destroyers, then your life was on the line, and a lot of times they didn't make it. There were about something in the area of 800 or so German submarines that were sunk, usually with all hands.
I was going to say, if a ship is sunk, obviously there's much more opportunity for the sailors manning the ship to, you know, to escape, to get on a lifeboat or whatever. But with a submarine, it's got to be much more difficult, right? I mean, I would imagine it would be much more difficult to survive a submarine sinking. You're right. Okay, yeah. I mean, you know, again, I'm no expert
in this
sort of thing.
Look at it this way. The surface ships were in packs or task forces if you were Navy. So if one ship gets sunk, you get into a lifeboat and your buddies will pull you out. Submarines operate alone, even though they have wolf packs. They might be 20, 30 miles apart. And if you're running 400 feet down, you have zero chance of getting out. A depth charge goes off. You don't even drown because you've got umpty zillion pressures, atmospheric pressures of water pressing on the hull. And if a depth charge goes off and blows a hole in it, your air inside immediately goes from one atmosphere to hundreds of atmospheres and you just die instantly. But if you get hit up on the surface, you go down and down and down and then the boat crushes in. It's like a beer can full of flies on the interstate that gets run over by a semi, and it's not a good way to die.
No.
They were the cream of the crop, though. The American submariners, the German submariners, they were the best of the best in the Navy.
Right. Well, I'm curious. I want to ask you, I mean, because you've met a lot of veterans, not only in Germany, but in other countries as well. But especially with Germany, I mean, if you look at America, I mean, we have American Legion posts. We have veterans of foreign wars. Organizations.
Yep.
And I mean, we honor our retired and even active duty or, you know, currently serving military members. How about in Germany? I mean, I'd got to imagine that there's a lot of stigma associated with some of these veterans which is really, really tragic in my mind. But I'm just curious, how were German veterans, especially U-boat veterans, treated in Germany?
You're talking about World War what? Adolf who?
Yeah, exactly.
They didn't even teach 1939 to 1945 for a lot of years. And I was going to a lot of the Marina Kameradschaft, Navy groups, or the U-boat groups. You know, the Legion post I belong to flies the flag out front, and they got a Huey helicopter out front. Not there. The ones in Hamburg, of course, they're out of existence now, I think, because they're all dead, old age. But they had to meet in a rented house owned by the U-boat skipper that owned the hotel. This was a house right behind there. In Austria, in the town of Klagenfurt, which is a county seat, I guess, nice-sized town, they have their meetings downstairs in what used to be a coal bin. And it's about probably 80 feet by 20 feet, and that's their headquarters. They can have their headquarters there. They can have their clubhouse, headquarters, whatever you call it, but don't expect to see a flag outside or a sign or nothing. World War what? You know, they
right. So there's no like honor or reverence for any of these veterans.
No. Otto Kretschmer, the greatest submarine commander of the war, and went on to command for NATO. He died. His wife was not even allowed to have a funeral. They had to cremate him and dump him into the North Sea.
Wow. That is very, very depressing to hear. Yeah.
The German newspapers didn't even mention it. The British newspapers gave him a very positive, very honorable write-up, but the German newspapers, nothing. And when we go over there, I have to tell people, do not even think about sticking your right arm in the air or kidding around like that, because you get arrested right there, because they got undercover cops everywhere. Certain songs you sing, you can't do it over there. And if I had a swastika ring, which I don't, I would have to leave it home. But the spitlickers claim that I wear a swastika ring. I don't even own a swastika ring, but in their mind, I do. I'm looking at the ring on my hand. It's a gold band that my wife put there, and I haven't taken it off since my wife put it there. But but anybody who has a swastika ring or anything like that, I tell them, just don't even bring it with you. Leave it at home. Don't look for trouble, because they don't kid
exactly
around that.
No, they do not. And there's plenty of examples of people that have been specifically targeted, not for crime, not for, you know, actual crimes that they've committed, but for simply publicly expressing opinions that, you know, deviate from the officially sanctioned narrative of World War II, which, in my view, is almost entirely an inversion of reality, or at the very least, it's a major distortion of this critical part of not only American history, but really the entire world's history. And it's so one-sided, it's so biased, it's so unfair, and just, I mean, it's incredible. Give us your take, just like in general, not specifically about certain alleged events, but just like generally speaking, the narrative of World War II, and, you know, maybe you just comment on it in general. How is it used in society? Certainly it's used to keep the Germans down. It's a totally weaponized narrative that is just totally demonizing the Germans in every single way.
Yeah, we wouldn't have weaponized anybody over here, would we? The three biggest lies of World War II can be summed up in one sentence, which we had been taught from the time I was a kid. The sentence is World War II. Strike that. The sentence is Adolf Hitler started World War II to kill all the Jews and to rule the world. First off, he didn't start the war. It was the Polish. And Churchill was probably the biggest culprit. Secondly, to kill all the Jews? I had a good friend over there, Helmut Schmuckel. He was a Jew. He was a U-boat commander. Wait a minute. Weren't we supposed to kill all them? And there was another guy, Helmut Rosenbaum, was a U-boat commander that sank one of the Brits' biggest aircraft carriers. I've been in cemeteries. There were German soldiers who died fighting for Germany. So Hitler didn't start the war. He obviously wasn't killing all the Jews. As a matter of fact, the guy that rebuilt the Luftwaffe was Erhard Milch, who was 100% Jewish. And as for controlling the world, when I talked about that with my friend Otto Kretschmer, he started laughing. He said, with what? They had no air force that could carry on like our B-17s and later the B-29s. They had fighters and two-engine bombers. Ships? We had hundreds and hundreds of transport ships, battleships, cruisers. We almost like you just put them in a microwave and they pop right out. Germany had precious little. They had a great land army, but they went up against the Russians, who could sacrifice 1 million people today and come back with 2 million more tomorrow. As a matter of fact, the Russians don't even consider that World War II. They call that the Great Patriotic War, because they won the war all by themselves. The U.S. and the Brits, gave them some few food and gave them a couple of fighter planes in their mind. I went through the Red Army Museum. Everything is circled around them. So, the massacres of the ethnic Germans by the Polish is what set it off, but that's another whole direction.
Yeah, and again, this is a topic that the Barnes Review has covered pretty extensively over the years, including in one of the issues published just this year. I believe it was either issue 2 or 3. I can't recall off the top of my head, and I do not have my magazines right here in front of me. But you're right. I mean, the idea that Hitler started World War II or wanted World War II is totally false. I mean, he was doing everything in his power to prevent war from breaking out, trying to negotiate with the Poles and with the Western allies, for that matter, and working as hard as to prevent a world war from igniting once again, which, I mean, he experienced. He fought in World War I, and it was a very probably the most defining aspect of his life, and he absolutely did not want anything like that happening again. And also, I wanted to mention really quickly, I've never actually read this book, but I'm familiar with it. I've heard people talk about it. It's called Hitler's Jewish Soldiers. It's written by a guy named Brian Mark Rigg, who's like a mainstream academic. And I mean, he documents there was like over 150,000 Jews that served in the German military, either like outright like full-blooded Jews, or they were like partially Jewish or whatever. And in many cases, the National Socialists were not applying their racial policies when it came to these people. Like, so, I mean, there was a lot of Jews that were actually serving in the German military, which is very much contrary to the mainstream narrative of Hitler hating all the Jews and certainly wanting to murder them all and stuff like that. So just a very simplistic way of looking at the situation. But anyways, I wanted to mention
so many
that
people,
I think it's interesting.
Yeah, so many people who control the narrative want everything to be black and white, and it can't always be black and white. You got to have some gray in there. And you mentioned, and that's why I was chuckling a minute ago, Hitler didn't want war, right? And we know that he presented at least 20 peace proposals to Churchill before the U.S. ever got involved in it, and Churchill turned them all down. So then Rudolf Hess flew out, and one of our members, Charles Higham, got into the archives, got everything he needed to prove that Hess was on a mission. He was supposed to parachute out over the lands of the Duke of some damn thing or another, who was a cousin to the king. And so Hitler thought by having Hess go over and see this guy, he could get his peace proposal right to the king. Well, Churchill's people had broken the code, and they knew he was coming, and they grabbed him. So Charles Higham, he was a member early on. He was member number 40, I think. We're up to almost 9,000 now. But he was updating me every day about what he was doing, what he had learned, and how his book was coming along, proving that Hitler had tried to prevent the war and that Hess was on an actual mission to stop the war. And he called me one evening. He was so excited. He had the book finished. He said he had the manuscript all packaged up and all the documentation, all the backup, all in a big package, and he was going to send it to his publisher the next morning. The next morning, he woke up dead.
Wow,
and all the stuff
kidding.
Was gone. Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, it happens.
That's, exactly, especially for people, you know, reporting on issues like this. There have been a number of books that have been released over the years about the, you know, about Rudolf Hess, including actually one by his son, I believe, who wrote a pretty lengthy, like a pretty detailed article explaining the whole situation, the background. And if I'm not mistaken, it's been a while since I've read it, but I believe he even alleged that Hess was murdered by British authorities in the prison. And that certainly
would be a dummy not to believe it.
Yeah, I was going to say that certainly wouldn't surprise me. But again, this is something that is just totally covered up.
I remember way back in the old days, Hess was the only guy in Spandau prison, and every 3 months the guards would change. One quarter would be the Americans, one would be the Brits, one would be the French, and one would be the Soviets. And I remember, because I'm an old guy, I remember back. The Brits, the Americans, and the French kept saying, let him out because we're running this prison for one guy. And the Soviets kept saying, nope, 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 niet, niet, niet. Well, then one day the Soviets said, okay, we agree, let him out. So to me, maybe I'm naive, that means you go turn the key in the lock, you give the guy a suit of clothes, you give him a couple of bucks for bus fare and tell him hit the trail. No, the Brits had the prison. I mean, they were guarding the prison that time. And this old man, who was so crippled with arthritis, he couldn't get his arms up over his waist. He was so excited about being released, he tied a lamp cord over a beam above his head and hanged himself. In one of our previous magazines, we named the two SAS guys who killed him.
Wow. Yeah, no, I'm fairly familiar with the story. It's another tragedy of World War II.
Sure.
And there's all sorts of issues like this that just aren't talked about. You know, nobody in America or in the West really knows about these things. Certainly you know, we talked about the deaths of the captured German soldiers and German civilians after World War II, the situation with Rudolf Hess, just the overall policy of Germany leading up to the war and in Hitler's stance on the war. I mean, it's none of it's presented objectively. That certainly doesn't surprise me. One topic we got to get to before we wrap up here. I said I'd keep you about an hour, and we've already approached the hour. You're probably
That's
best
up to
known.
You. I got more time than you got. I can stay as long as you want.
Okay. Yeah. Well, let's definitely talk about your theory, your idea that Hitler escaped from the bunker in Berlin at the end of the war. This would have been, what, like April 1945?
It's not a theory.
Right. Well, I was going to say, the Southern Poverty Law Center, this is why they characterize you as a conspiracy theorist, because, you know, you've been one of the leading proponents of this idea, of this pretty well-documented idea that...
Did you ever think a theory could possibly be correct?
Right, exactly. Well yeah, tell me about it, because it's something that I frankly haven't done enough research into it to come, you know, to come to any sort of a conclusion. I'm certainly open to the idea. I think it's interesting. So,
you should have got one of my books.
Yeah. No, explain it. Walk us through the facts and the evidence
simply,
that you garnered over the years.
Yes, he was pretty well beaten down, and he was ready to die. Bormann, who's the number two man in the Reich, but in reality was the power behind the throne at this point in time. He wanted Hitler alive. He wanted to come up with a Fourth Reich. And he had Hitler forcibly drugged and Eva Braun. One of our members, who's now passed on, was an actual Abwehr agent who worked for the German Abwehr, their spook force, and he was a Spaniard by the name of Don Angel Alcazar de Velasco. And he kept telling me back in the early 80s that Hitler didn't die in the bunker. Yeah. We all know that he blew his brains out in the bunker and all that. And no. So he sent me his findings, a typewritten letter, single-spaced, 114 pages long, backed up with documentation from the FBI. And I went back to the National Archives and got more and more and more. We have dozens and dozens of FBI files that flat out state they knew he got away. They knew he was in South America. Stalin knew it. Truman knew it. They all knew he got away. So the FBI was trying to get him. And about middle 1947, Harry Truman told the FBI, close the case, don't look for him, just back off. Well, we know there was a quid pro quo. My career field in the Air Force was special weapons, nuclear weapons. And 6 months intensive training in atom bombs and hydrogen bombs. The first week, we watched all the movies of the American nuclear program, and our guys weren't doing so well. The Japanese had test-fired their first atomic device 1 week before we test-fired ours. And they didn't have any more fissionable material, and we had very little. The problem our guys were having was the triggering device. Now, to make an atom bomb go off, and you have to have an atom bomb inside of a hydrogen bomb to make it go off too, but to make the atom bomb go off, you got a lump of enriched uranium about the size of an orange. And it's surrounded by 64 shaped charges of comp B and baryton. And they all have to go off at the exact same zillionth of a second, so they squish in and form critical mass. If one goes off a millionth of a second too soon or too late, you got nothing but junk flying around. And our guys were having trouble. One of the big German cargo submarines surrendered a few days after the war ended, after they got, you know, they were in the North Atlantic and wasn't picking up the radio. Finally got the radio message that they were supposed to go surrender. So they came to Portsmouth, New Hampshire. They radioed in and were met up by USS Sutton that convoyed them in. Among all the other stuff on board, they had an ME-262 jet fighter in crates with all the technological data for the Japanese to put it together and all sorts of stuff. Plus, they had 560 kilos of uranium on board in gold-lined stainless steel flasks. And they had a guy named Heinz Schlicker, who later became a member of Shark Hunters, Dr. Heinz Schlicker, who was the world's number one expert on infrared triggers. Imagine that. All of a sudden, our guys knew what they were doing. Our bombs were going off. And if you remember your history, the first major one was the Trinity Project, in which they had a tower, 300-400 feet high, something like that. And they had a nuclear device up there. And they triggered it from afar. And they had a small little suburb built 2 miles away, 5 miles away, 10 miles away to check the blast. The guy in charge of that was Dr. Heinz Schlicker, and he later became a member of Shark Hunters. So there's no question in my mind there was a quid pro quo. Leave Hitler alone. He won't do anything, because by that time Martin Bormann realized that raising a million-man army wasn't such a hot setup, and he had tons and tons of money. So he founded about 750 corporations down there in Buenos Aires, many of which are still functioning today. I've been down there 11 times. I found where he was. I found where Mengele was. And a lot of the other guys who history hardly even touches on, gone into neighborhoods where the police wouldn't even go into. And, you know, if you got a cell phone, they'll kill you for your cell phone. Well, I had my cell phone on my hip. And if you got a camera, they'll kill you for your camera. I had my camera going. We never saw anybody look threatening at all. We got all this information, and it's in so many of our books. We got 4 books in the Hitler Escape series, and there is no doubt whatsoever. And we might ask this question. People say that he lived near the town of San Carlos de Bariloche. Actually, he lived about 60 kilometers out in the country. However, there's an incredible luxury 5-diamond, 10-diamond resort hotel down there. Beautiful, magnificent place. And one might ask, why was President Eisenhower at this hotel during his presidency? And why was Jimmy Carter a guest at this hotel during his presidency? And why was Bill Clinton at this hotel during his presidency? And why was Barack Obama there during his presidency? And why was Secretary of State John Kerry down there when he was still Secretary of State? Kind of gets the gray matter buzzing, doesn't it, John?
Yeah, no, that's interesting. What was the name of the city you said in Argentina?
San Carlos de Bariloche.
Okay.
Bariloche.
Okay, I see it right here. I'm just curious. I just pulled up Google Maps. I just want to see where that's at.
About 700 miles southwest of Buenos Aires. Beautiful area, incredible. And Hitler was in an estate, like I say, about 60 kilometers out, right on the shore of this incredibly gorgeous lake.
Yeah, I see the lake, yeah.
Backed up by the Andes Mountains. When I got off the plane there the first time, I thought I'd gotten off in Munich. All the houses are built in the Bavarian style. I don't speak Spanish, but I get along fine with my German down there. And this house.
Well, there was already a sizable German population that had settled in, not only in Argentina, but other South American countries, right? I mean, even in like Peru, I remember I studied abroad actually in Peru, and there was a part of Lima that was very German.
Right. Shortly after the turn of the last century, like 1905, 6, 7, Argentina especially was giving away huge tracts of land, and almost all of it went to Germans, some went to Italians, which is the subject of my second book, Hitler and the Secret Alliance. How is it could tens of thousands of Germans escape the crumbled Reich and just be assimilated so smoothly into another country, which was Argentina? But they did. And so many of those cities down there, towns, whatever, you got blue-eyed, blonde-haired kids running around speaking Spanish. And all through, especially in Paraguay, so many towns have German names in them. And we zeroed in on a town called Hohenau, which is where Mengele had set up his headquarters. So they were there, no question about it. The guy who designed the Focke Wulf FW-190, which was Germany's best fighter plane, he moved down to South America. He was not wanted for anything. He took 50 aeronautical engineers with him, and they designed fighter planes for various different South American air forces. And here's one thing that even caught me by surprise. My friend down there, Martin, the guy who can find everything, we were in Uruguay, and we were in some dink water little town, which was nothing but a crossroad with a gas station and a restaurant. And the gas station guy was about 40 years old. He was so proud. He had a collection of Third Reich postage stamps. Okay, fine. We're talking. And he says, well, I have a friend who lives nearby whose grandfather was in the Luftwaffe. Would you like to meet him? I said, yeah, it sure would. So he arranged it. We buzzed over there. Big, strapping guy, a 6'2", blue-eyed, blonde guy, spoke excellent English with a German accent and Spanish with a German accent. And we're talking, and he's talking about his grandfather and his brother who joined the Luftwaffe. Okay, that's nice. A lot of them did. And they learned to fly on gliders. That's nice. That's the only way they could learn because Germany was not allowed powered airplanes in the beginning. And then he said, but my grandfather and his brother decided they didn't want to fly airplanes. They wanted to design and build airplanes. Maybe you heard of my grandfather. His name was Reimer Horton. Holy cow! The Horton brothers built the first jet-powered flying wing stealth bomber in Germany, and it was operational in 1944. And this guy was the grandson of the guy who designed it. So he brought us into his house. He was showing us all the design programs that had come down father to son, and he showed me letters of appreciation from the United States Air Force for him helping design the F-117 Nighthawk and the B-2 stealth bomber. And then the guy says, my father would know more about it than me. Would you like to meet my father? Oh, my God. It's like falling into, you know, a pile of gold coins almost. So those guys are members of Shark Hunters. And we got, you know, we get people like that all over the place.
Sorry to go off that topic. Interesting. No, I want to go back because the idea is that Bormann – Hitler actually did want to commit suicide. Is that what you said? Like he genuinely wanted to.
He was ready to die, but Bormann had him, and this guy Don Angel Alcazar de Velasco, who I was in contact with a lot, he physically saw Hitler and Eva Braun drugged, forcibly, and removed from the bunker. Then, if you look.
This was April 1945. So Hitler gets to Argentina against his will, apparently, and he's just down there and he's I guess one of the major things that doesn't make sense to me is he was always so outspoken and, you know, just truly a leader. So he's just down in Argentina and just gives it all up and realizes the fight is over.
Well, he got stuck way out in Booneyville, and, you know, sometimes it's best not to make a lot of noise because if people are going to try to kill you, and there were a couple attempts on his life that didn't succeed, but like I say, Bormann decided he didn't need a million-man army, so he stuck Hitler out in this out-of-the-way place, a huge, beautiful home. I've been there umpty zillion times, and the last time we were there, we spent the night there. It's been abandoned ever since Hitler moved out in 1955 when Juan Perón, their protector, got kicked out of office at gunpoint. The place where he lived, which is called Inalco, somebody told me that means water's edge or something, that building, the estate, and several guest houses, etc., were built by money from Mercedes of Argentina. It was supposed to be rest and recreation for their executives right on the shore of the lake. And nobody was there until Hitler moved in. He got down to – he flew as far as Uruguay. They had an airplane that had incredible long legs, 7,000, 8,000 miles. And it landed in Uruguay. We were at the place it landed. We talked to people who heard the plane land. You know, if a plane the size of a 757 lands in a field, you're bound to notice it. Then from there he went by train. But the train ended at a huge ranch called the Estancia San Ramon, where they stayed because they got there in July, that dead of winter down there. And there was no way to get from there to the home, about another 70 kilometers, until the warm weather. So they stayed there at this Estancia San Ramon. So I went there some years ago, met the manager, nice young man, spoke English with a German accent, and I don't do ambush things like Mike Wallace. I tell him I'm a researcher, I'm a writer, and I start asking softball questions first. And then when everybody's at ease, I ask a very important question. So we came to that point, and I looked around. There's all these guest houses. I said, can you please show me which guest house Adolf Hitler and Eva Braun stayed in from July of 45 until about January or February? It would have been the easy thing to say, hey, I'm only 40 years old. I have no idea. No. I remembered as if he said it to me 5 minutes before you called. He said, I am ordered. I may not speak about that time. Red flags.
That is, yeah, that's interesting.
Yep. Yep. So, you know, people down there, when I say I'm getting evidence that Hitler lived down here, they think I'm nuts because everybody knows it down there. Of course he did. We know that. Why are you asking? Well, because people up north don't know it in the northern hemisphere. The three testimonies, the three guys, Linga, Gunther, and Kempke. Linga was his butler or whatever you want to call it. Gunther was his adjutant, and Kempke was his driver. They were all majors in the SS. Each one told a different story to the Soviets, because they got grabbed up by the Soviets. Two of them said that Eva Braun was sitting on the right side of a sofa. Hitler was sitting in the middle of the sofa, and he put the pistol to his right temple and blew his brains out. Excuse me. And the third guy said Eva Braun was laying on the sofa, and Hitler was seated at a chair across the room. That's a hell of a discrepancy. Plus, also, Hitler was right-handed. If he had put the gun to his right temple, the blood splatter would have come out the left side of his head, yet the blood splatter is all over the wall on the right side. Hello. And then, of course, you see the picture of the dead Hitler with the bullet hole right in his forehead. Nobody shoots himself right in the forehead. It's next to impossible to turn a pistol around and point it at your forehead. Guys shoot themselves in the temple or in the mouth. Nobody shoots himself straight in the forehead. So, and of course we hear that the Russians had the body, and then we only had his skull, and then we find out it wasn't his skull after all. So, if they'd have had
Hitler's body. Well, the official, yeah, I was going to say, like, the official narrative, I mean, I'm looking at the Wikipedia entry, and it basically says.
God, that's.
Yeah, yeah.
It's got to be right if Wikipedia has.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it does sort of, you know, outline the mainstream narrative, and that's Hitler shot himself in the head. Eva yeah. Braun, you know, bit into a cyanide capsule.
Poisoned.
They were, yeah, and they were taken outside, and their bodies were burned, right? That's like the official story.
Yeah, but you can't, you know, they poured gasoline on them. You can't cremate a body with just pouring gasoline on them. You know, in
right.
a crematorium, it takes yeah. quite a while, and it takes a lot of heat. So
it is, I do got to admit, it is very mysterious, you know, because, I mean, from the sounds of it, his body was really never recovered, right?
Right.
And never properly identified, yeah.
Right. I love it when I'm having a conversation with these diehards, and they yell at me, they have the body. So who has the body? The Russians. They have it in the Red Army Museum. And I tell them, yet, я вас почутный русский подводник. What? I tell them, I'm an honorary Russian submarine officer. I've been all through the Red Army Museum. There ain't no Hitler in there. And if Stalin would have had Hitler, even if he had been burnt, he'd have been behind glass in the Kremlin wall. And I've been there, and there ain't no Hitler in the Kremlin wall. He ain't
so
in the Red Army Museum.
Okay. And so why the – you said there's a you know, basically a deal worked out with nuclear technology after he actually made it.
Not only nuclear technology, but NASA, for instance. Everybody in NASA was brought right over from the German rocket program and given jobs here at NASA. The head of NASA, although people think it was Wernher von Braun, no, he was the top engineer, but the guy in charge was a guy by the name of Dr. Kurt Debus. He was head of the German rocket program in Peenemünde. Von Braun was one of his best, and they brought over hundreds of German rocket engineers, and that became NASA. And we
right,
got,
yeah, and that's pretty well documented, pretty well known, that the Germans were basically the founders of NASA. You know, they're brought over
yeah.
to America after the war. Yeah, interesting. I got to admit, it's a very interesting idea. I'm not convinced one way or the other, but I definitely want to learn more. I definitely need to read your book, and it sounds like you've written a series of them. So yeah, I'm gonna have to get my hands on those.
Well, there's four books in the Hitler Escapes series, but the most important, the most revealing one is the first one, Hitler in Argentina. You read that, and read all the eyewitness accounts. And I've, even after I've written the book, I've interviewed people who saw him down there. I've got it on videotape. And you, if you read the book and you read all the FBI reports in the book, we got dozens of FBI reports. If you still think he blew his brains out in the bunker, then let me tell you about this bridge I have for sale in Brooklyn.
Well, so, I mean, did he just realize that, you know, basically he wasn't going to win and live the rest of his life down there, like sort of in seclusion?
That's the next book I'm coming out with. I had a whole bunch of top secret files that I promised not to release for 25 years. Well, I've been sitting on them for 27 years, and we're starting to release them, and it tells all about what he was doing down there and all the other operations going on down there. The commando forces they the Germans had in Argentina. I published a picture some time ago of some really sharp-looking German troops with the German uniforms and German trucks, German machine guns, only they ain't German, they was Argentine. And the Chilean soldiers, they had the same uniforms as the Black SS, only theirs was dark brown. So Germany was down there. We've got pictures of grave markers in, I think it's Brazil, all with swastikas on them, and dated 1936 when these guys died. So they were down there. I had a friend who passed away. He was a an electronics engineer with Telefunken in 1937 down there in Peru. An electronics engineer means a spook. And he was one of the two guys that got dropped off in Maine, November 1944, and he got caught and was scheduled to hang, but then Roosevelt died, and he went to prison for a while and went back over to Germany. And, you know, they were here. The spooks were here. And they were heavy in South America, very heavy. And in this book I'm putting together now, we show the last known operating German base way, way south in the Magellan Straits. It was still operating in 1952.
Very interesting. Well, I'm definitely looking forward to reading more about this and checking out some of the documents that you have that you're getting ready to release. So you're going to publish this in a book that's coming out soon? Or?
Yeah, that's correct. And okay. This Friday I'm going to be on Rents Radio for 2 hours. We'll be talking about the book.
Yeah, no, I saw your email about that. That's cool. I'm going to have to tune in and check that out.
Yep.
Yeah, very, very interesting. Well, Harry, we'll go ahead and wrap it up there. We covered a lot of territory. Thank you very much for sticking with me for even over the hour. And, yeah, we'll definitely have to stay in touch. I'd like to do this again in the future. Maybe we can do another interview after I review some of this material and hear what you got to say on Rents' program. And, yeah, it's
sounds
it's
like a plan.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story, and I'm not totally dismissing the idea. It's just something I need to do a little bit more research into. What did Willis think?
I know. I'm curious.
I'm curious.
I've done all the research, so I know.
Yeah. What was Willis? Did he agree with you, or I don't know if I've ever heard him talk about it or write about it or anything.
No. Well, yeah. He and I and Paul Angel got together to release a book early on, many, many moons ago. However, Willis's wife, Elizabeth, nice lady, very nice lady. However, concrete head when it comes to Hitler. Oh, no, my hero would not take the coward's way out and run. He would commit suicide, okay. The honorable thing. And she just would not open her mind. I think shooting yourself in a dingy old basement, that's kind of a coward's way out. But then what the hell? I could never bring myself to shoot myself.
Right, yeah. Wow, very interesting. Okay, well, Harry, thank you very much, man. I really appreciate it. And once again,
my pleasure.
The website's sharkhunters.com. You can find more information about your organization. And some of these topics even that we've been talking about, I know under, I think it's under the reviews section, you can find the tab Hitler's Escape Overview, where you got some videos sort of explaining all this. So definitely check that out for anybody that's interested. And yeah, thanks, man. I really appreciate it. We'll stay in touch, and we'll do this again in the future.
Sounds like a plan, John. Remember, anybody, send me an email, sharkhunters@sharkhunters.com, and I'll send you all the information you need.
All right. Thanks, Harry. Appreciate it.
Okay. Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.